Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 11, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss recent developments in state AG lawsuits against energy producers. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will also be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome a return guest, the Honorable C. Boyden Gray. He's the founding partner at Boyden Gray & Associates right here in Washington, D.C. Ambassador Gray is going to begin with some opening remarks, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. With that, Ambassador Gray, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you, Dean. The topic is the question of what appears to be a concerted effort by state AGs and some NGOs, environmental groups, to do as much as they can to disparage the oil companies on the grounds that they are, in some singular way, responsible for climate change and for bad things that have happened in terms of hurricanes and whatnot. And the evidence is, of course, in terms of precise output and precise results, the evidence is hard to parse. Some countries benefit actually from a warmer climate. Some countries don't. The U.S. is probably a country that, to some degree, I mean, to make a pun, but to some degree, the U.S. benefits from a warmer climate because our agricultural production increases, productivity increases, and deaths from cold-related health problems, such as the flu, are rather, you know, seriously reduced. So it's a very mixed set of questions and not susceptible to resolution in a court case, which is what these activists and AGs have been trying to find a way to set up for the last 5 or 6 years. And the latest salvo in this has been a pushback by the oil companies to highlight the discrepancy in statements made by the municipalities in California that are on the coast about the danger, a potential danger of sea rise, sea increases, level increases, and what's clear from the judicial record that's already been established, which is being done in Texas, where they have a procedure under which a potential defendant or potential plaintiff can get pre-suit, pre-litigation discovery before actually filing suit. And that's what a couple of oil companies have done, and they've brought out the rather striking discrepancy between what these municipalities have alleged the oil companies to have done in terms of damaging their own prospects and that of similarly affected entities, and then what they say to their own investors when they raise bond issues to pay for local government. And the allegations against the oil companies are really quite strident, quite definitive, quite declaratory, quite striking. But the coverage of the same set of issues in their public documents, investment documents, really do undermine almost everything they've said in these lawsuit contexts. Some of the municipalities simply don't even refer to climate change in particular at all, And others say, well, we are unable to predict, we are unable to quantify, we can't tell you what's going to happen. Something may happen, but we can't quantify it. And, of course, that's really quite inconsistent with what they say in court when they're suing the oil companies. And the circle simply cannot be squared. And that is something that I think people ought to be aware of. It represents a larger point that while I think most scientists, even ones who are skeptical about the extreme claims of other scientists, most scientists agree there has been warming. You know, we had a medieval ice age that peaked in 1750, and we have been warming ever since. We are warmer now than we were 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago. How much man has contributed to that is very up for grabs. No one really knows. But it's a worldwide problem. It's not capable of resolution by a trial court in California, let alone a federal court such as potentially the Supreme Court at the federal level. And one case that I might mention so that we don't get too far away from the law in this podcast, because we are a legal group. One case that I think should be mentioned is AEP versus Connecticut, decided about 10 years ago, where the plaintiffs invoked, or tried to invoke, in the Second Circuit in New York, the federal common law of nuisance as the grounds for regulating utilities. And the Supreme Court ruled fairly definitively that the federal common law of nuisance was preempted, or displaced is the legal word, displaced by the Clean Air Act, even though the government had not done much at that stage under the Clean Air Act at all. But potentially it could, and so the Supreme Court said the federal common law of nuisance was displaced. Now, we don't really have any direct precedent about whether this would preempt state law, but the spirit animating the AEP case, American Electric Power, that's a utility based in Ohio, that the spirit animating the case is that courts are just simply not qualified to deal with something which is a worldwide issue and takes entities other than courts, which can only deal with concrete cases. You have to have an entity or set of entities that can take a much broader view of what's going on. For example, and then I will try to open it up for questions. For example, the allegation is that these defendants, these oil companies that are being charged in this sort of activist effort by the AGs, have, as alleged, accounted for 11% of all carbon and methane emissions since the beginning of time, but that's only a fraction of all the greenhouse gases. The most powerful of which is chlorofluorocarbons, which we, the United States, and the Montreal Protocol led the world in abolishing, basically, not directly for climate reasons, but for other environmental reasons involving the so-called ozone hole in the stratosphere. So the United States has nothing to be apologetic about. It's actively engaged in the Clean Air Act. We have the cleanest traditional air pollution, and we have the lowest air pollution, traditional air pollution of probably any country in the Western world, and we have led the world in carbon reduction in the last couple of decades since fracking got underway, opening up natural gas, which has displaced a lot of the coal because it's cheaper. A lot of coal use in the United States. So, and California, of course, is very actively involved, not only in terms of automobile efficiency, but they've got a CO2 trading regime, which involves several other big states in conjunction with what they're doing. So there's a lot of activity at the federal level, a lot of activity at the state level, and we have not abandoned the field. This is not a question of turning a blind eye to a serious problem that deserves serious scientific and legal attention, but we're trying to be, I think, reasonable about the way it's approached, and the courts are not the way to do it. I should point out, in my one sort of final opening note, that Germany has, in effect, abandoned its own climate goals that it made in terms of the Paris Accords, the Paris Treaty, which deals with climate change. So in effect, the Germans have dropped out too, which is just an illustration of the difficulty of dealing with these issues, and the fact that it's going to take some time, maybe a long time, to get to the bottom of it. But we do have the time to do it because of the greenhouse gas reductions produced by the Montreal Protocol beginning almost 2 decades ago. So, Dean, that's where I'll leave it and open it up for questions.
Very good. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for Ambassador Gray, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open while we wait to see if somebody rings in. Let me just make a quick commercial announcement about our next scheduled teleforum conference call tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about the case of the deductibility of the Parsonage Housing Allowance. That's tomorrow at noon Eastern Time at this same number. Today, of course, we're talking about energy producers and lawsuits against them. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me get things started here with a reticent audience. You mentioned that courts are not the best body to decide these issues, and then you went on to talk about how the United States has not abandoned the field. And I want to make sure that I'm not misreading you. I suppose that even had there been an affirmative policy decision by the policymakers to abandon the field, saying we've done enough as a country, it's the courts would still be precisely the wrong entity to second guess that sort of judgment.
Absolutely. The courts are the last place you should try to seek any resolution or attention to these issues. A retrospective damage award does nothing to help figure out what can be done, what's the most efficient way to do it, and do it on an international basis, which is the way it must be done since this is an international issue. So, yeah, I mean, even if the United States had said we're out of the whole picture and we're going to seek repeal of the Clean Air Act and we're going to do X, Y, and Z, the courts would still be the wrong place to deal with this.
Good. Just making sure there. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Let's check in with our first caller.
Thank you. I actually wanted to ask about Bill de Blasio's announcement yesterday, for not the divestment one, but that the city of New York would also be looking to start suits, I think primarily against Exxon. So I just wanted to ask your opinion, how likely is his side to succeed in this case, given that, as I understand it, they are trying to use that public nuisance structure?
Well, I don't think the chances, I don't think the prospects are very good for his effort, and I think it's being done really for political reasons. I mean, people do sue for political reasons, not for strictly legal ones. That's not unusual or unique, but it is still, I think, a PR effort more than it is a legal one, because I don't think it may be that a court would say the city of New York has no standing, And there is, of course, an element of, a small element of, or maybe a large element of hypocrisy. New York City burns itself in terms of the subway and the mass transit and the medallion system for taxi cabs and whatnot. They burn an enormous amount of carbon, and the city couldn't exist without fossil fuels. It simply couldn't exist at all. And so there's a certain hypocrisy in all of this, and that's one of the reasons why it's an issue that needs to be dealt with in the context of a set of governmental entities that are capable of taking in all the facts and not trying to adjudicate as a precise issue something which is global in nature.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. I'll ask another question here, and that's, I've heard the nuisance theory of recovery mentioned a couple times, both by you and the caller, which brings to my mind the notion of a nuisance suit. I'm wondering what you judge to be the likelihood of success of a lawsuit, of the initial lawsuits like this. Are they... And I don't want to get too much into the motives of the plaintiffs, but are they designed to? Do you think there might have been an expectation that there'd just be a quick settlement? So those are the questions.
You know, I don't know whether the motivation is a financial one. I think the motivation is political. It's emotional for a lot of people. Divestment becomes a question of almost belief and faith rather than hard facts and reality. And I don't want to be critical of people's motives and beliefs and whatnot, but the courts are not the place to do this. I don't think divestment is the way to go on this. I don't think that's appropriate behavior on behalf of a pension fund or a university endowment. The marketplace will take care of some of these issues, and oil is not necessarily going to be the key to the 21st century or the 22nd century the way it has been since the First World War. There was a interesting now sort of famous comment made by a Saudi oil minister who said, you know, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone. And Bjorn Lomborg, who was a Scandinavian scientist, believes that the current focus on trying to get a concrete result out of reducing some ton of CO2 here or some ton there is very misplaced. He's not a climate denier. He doesn't believe that climate change is not happening, but he just thinks that technology will take us to a place where we will solve this in an orderly way that really doesn't disrupt the world economy. Because at the moment you can't imagine the world without fossil fuels, and that doesn't mean that they will control the marketplace 100 years from now or 50 years from now. But today, it's a reality. We can't get along without them.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending now, so let's head in the direction of our next caller.
I missed the beginning of this call, so maybe this is already covered, but I'm interested in what your thoughts are on the public trust doctrine theory for global warming and climate change-related litigation, especially under this one appellate case that's working right now where you know, a bunch of people, everyone from like a 15-year-old to like a professor saying they will represent the future population in terms of a public trust theory. So I'm wondering if I can get some thoughts on that.
I don't know what the content of a I don't know how it would be applied to deal with this. How would a court adjudicate what one's obligations are in such a under such a such a theory. I think it's just impossible for the court or any court to adjudicate that. You know, this is an oversimplification, but the administrative law premise of this country and most of the developed world is to do things in the context of what we administrative lawyers call rulemaking, where you get comments from the whole landscape of interested parties, people who are interested in the science, people who are interested in this, people who are interested in that. And the agency in charge, either alone or in conjunction with other agencies that have overlapping responsibilities, is to try to sort through all of this. Well, courts don't do that. Courts don't hold notice and comment rulemaking. Courts don't have appended to them dozens and dozens and dozens of assignments the way the Public Health Service has, or the Environmental Protection Agency has, or even the Department of Energy has, or the Department of Agriculture. All departments that have a role to play in this issue, they have expertise. Compared to the Congress, for example, a court can't begin to approximate the staffing levels of the ordinary congressional committee. It's just the court simply is not capable of dealing with these complex issues and figuring out what is the most efficient way of addressing them.
So Boyden, this is Dean. So there's an institutional problem here, but I wonder if you want to talk about accountability as well. I mean, it strikes me that congressmen are accountable to the public. They're elected officials in a way that judges aren't. Is that a factor here as well?
Well, it is, sure. I mean, they are elected officials. They have the public looking over their shoulder, as they should, and they are the ones who should take hold in the first instance of what to do. And in our country, you know, in the United States, what the Congress has done is to reject the Obama efforts to control climate change, and instead leave it to the existing law that predated Obama, the Clean Air Act, which does apply, and is being used to constrain the growth of these so-called pollutants. And that's fine, but people should just be aware that the Congress, when it was in Democratic hands under a Democratic president, rejected an ambitious program that would have put us at a huge disadvantage to the Chinese and the Indians and the rapidly growing parts of Asia, which are under no constraints, and which under Paris are given till 2030, China is, before it has to do anything. And if you want to commit economic suicide, that's the way to do it, is to say, all right, United States, you go first. You demilitarize, you denuclearize, you shut your economy down, and then we'll see what we'll do about it, you know, 2 decades later. Well, that's not a prescription for economic growth, opportunity, jobs, and ultimately the wealth that is going to be necessary to address the most extreme possibilities under a climate scenario.
We've got two questions pending again, so let's check in with our next caller.
I just wanted to get your comment on the kind of underlying strategy by Exxon here. It seems quite clever and interesting that they are asserting that if these California jurisdictions were really so worried about this as a risk, that they should have been disclosing the risk on their bond offerings. I thought that was quite funny and might be a good way for Exxon to expose how it is a political stunt. You want to comment on that strategy? I just thought it was amusing and worth a comment.
Well, that is basically the reason why we have this podcast is to bring to people's attention that there is this rather dramatic conflict in what these municipalities are saying. And that's what I think Exxon is trying to do, is to alert people to the fact that it just doesn't add up. Their behavior just doesn't square with the facts on the ground. And it's I'm interested in your characterization of it as clever. That makes it, that sort of has almost a connotation of not being sincere. And I think what Exxon is doing is sincere. There are all kinds of contradictions in the singling out of one set of companies. You know, in the United States, out of the whole world that have contributed to this, potentially contributed to this problem. It's a great publicity stunt. It makes people feel very good, I guess, when they can take a pound of flesh out of a extremely well-run company that does not deny that climate is real and has supported carbon taxes in the past. So it's not saying we are not prepared to do anything about it. We are prepared. We will support this. We would support that. But to take out after it in this way is quite, I think, unfair and counterproductive. And so Exxon's fighting back and saying, you know, watch your hypocrisy here. Watch what you're saying, because it's going to come back and bite you if you're not careful.
Right, agreed. I don't see anything disingenuous about it, but it's clever to kind of go outside the box and not fight in the same realm of only denying on the topic of climate change, but rather just pointing out the hypocrisy. That, in that sense, I thought of it as clever.
Well, I think it's a very effective tactic, frankly. I mean, if you read, and I could run through some of the quotes, and but you can get them probably. I think Dean Reuter can make them available at the Federalist Society if you'd like to see some of the summations of these statements. But the allegations that they make are simply completely undone by disclosures to bondholders.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Before we go to our next caller, Ambassador, I'm wondering, was there any corollary in the tobacco litigation? I'm thinking back to when tobacco companies were sued under, I guess, similar theories. But these were the same states and cities that were bringing the suits that were taxing tobacco and its citizens were using the products, obviously. You say that New York can't exist without fossil fuels. It probably could exist without cigarettes, but I suppose. But its citizens certainly were enjoying that illegal product, and the cities and states were enjoying tax revenue from those products. Did the tobacco companies ever push back in this same way?
Well, not really. Because the two situations are so different, there was a very substantial amount of public health evidence linking components of tobacco with you know, personal health harm, and a lot of epidemiology went into that, and the proof over the years became quite compelling, and that's in a sense, I think, why the tobacco companies ultimately settled, because of the nature of the evidence. But in this in this set of facts, we have no way of tracing what the 11% of methane and carbon produced by these, allegedly produced by these few oil companies, no way on earth of tracing that down to a manageable declaration of damages for some municipality in California. There's simply no way of doing this. And to try to look back and apportion damages, given all of the benefits that have come from a high energy economy like ours and like now China's and India's and Europe's, Japan's, it's just a totally different set of conditions, and so it's very, very difficult to compare the two. It's very, very difficult. It's just not, they're just not comparable.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's check in with another caller.
Thank you, sir. I wanted to ask you to comment on the legal theories that were previewed by Exxon in their filing, and in particular, a claim under Section 1983, their constitutional deprivation that they're talking about is viewpoint discrimination. And as to the municipalities, the policy element of that claim would certainly seem to be present by virtue of them filing these lawsuits. So could you comment on if you have any ideas about the prospects of those claims against the municipalities as it's articulated by Exxon in this filing?
Well, I think it's a very good argument. It's a little bit novel. I mean, there's not a whole lot of precedent for the lawsuits, and the constitutional aspects of it are also novel. But that doesn't mean they're not meaningful, and it doesn't mean they don't merit close judicial attention. The way Exxon's being, and the other oil companies, being treated here is from a strict legal perspective, is really quite irregular, and so I think they've got a good argument that they're being censored. They're being dispossessed of their rights as a company on grounds that they cannot get aired in a court context. And so it's sort of it becomes almost like a political game. And that's just, it's not productive. It's not going to help solve this problem in any way, shape, or form. And Exxon has got every right, if not a duty, to its shareholders and its customers and its suppliers and its employees. It's got a duty to say, look, This is the wrong way to do it, and you're doing it in ways that really do disadvantage our ecosystem, our employees, our customers, our suppliers, and our shareholders. And that's perfectly, I think it's perfectly appropriate, if not, in fact, demanded by the way they're being treated.
Thank you.
We do have two more questions pending now, so let's carry on. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, thank you. Hi, I was wondering if you can, do you have any predictions that you can share about other cities that might be following suit in a similar manner to New York and what we've seen in California?
I don't know. I think the group that is arranging all of this is not a politically diverse group. It's made up of AGs from Democratic states primarily, and it's So it, in that sense, it's quite political. And so I would look at other major Democratic cities, maybe Chicago, maybe San Francisco particularly, I don't know. You might see other cities in Democratic hands try to do something with this. Again, trying to make it into a political issue. But again, even at a political level, it doesn't really work. Because as I pointed out just a few minutes ago, President Obama had a very, very ambitious plan to put to the Congress, but he couldn't get it adopted, and it was ultimately defeated by Democrats, not by Republicans, but by Democrats who couldn't vote for it and didn't vote for it. So I don't really see this being widespread in terms of its political diversity, but I could see some more Democratic cities jumping in just to pile on, but I don't think it's going to do anything productive.
Characterize.
Let's take another call here. Go ahead, caller.
Why do you continue to characterize it as the problem, and why does Exxon continue to support carbon taxes when, first of all, you pointed out correctly at the beginning of this conference that to the extent there is warming, it benefits large swaths of the world, including the United States. Second, from the late 40s to the early 70s, during one of the biggest periods of world industrialization, the temperature actually fell. And among other things, number three, the Earth is actually much cooler than it was about 1,000 years ago.
Well, I want to make a couple of additional points for your position, but I have to say I'm not a scientist. I'm not qualified as a scientist. I'm not a geologist. I'm not a meteorologist. I'm a lawyer. And I accept the basic scientific framework because I can't quarrel with it. I can't answer the question. I don't represent Exxon in this matter. I can't tell you why they would support a carbon tax when you're arguing, well, you know, there really isn't anything to this at all. Well, I think from Exxon's position, they don't believe that there's nothing here. But when you get into the details, it becomes very, very interesting. And one detail, which most people don't, I think, fully appreciate, is that, has to do with the second biggest source of CO2 emissions in the world. You probably don't know what that is, but I'll ask the question, are you aware of what the second biggest source is?
I can guess it's one of two things, either humans exhaling or sheep and cattle farting.
No, it's
seriously about the latter.
Well, termites and cattle and do pass gas. They do. There's no question about it. And they are a major source. But the second biggest source of CO2 is actually cutting down parts of the rainforest in Brazil and Costa Rica and Borneo and wherever. But the point I'm trying to make is that the last 100 years in the United States has seen, east of the Mississippi, the greatest reforestation mm-hmm. in the history of mankind. Mm-hmm. For the first couple of hundred years in the United States, in the 17th and 18th centuries, the East was blanketed with forests, and it was all cut down to build America. To build ships, to build houses, to build office buildings, and to heat homes and whatnot. But in the last 100 years, with most of that having been accomplished and other building materials being used, we've had a massive reforestation occur east of the Mississippi. And as a result, we have deer coming into our gardens, if we were lucky enough to have a garden, eating all the flowers. Mm-hmm. In the suburbs, but the point is that reforestation sucked in an enormous amount of CO2, and it may very well be. I've never seen numbers. No one's ever run these numbers or published them. It may be that that the United States is not really a net producer of CO2 at all, if you look at it over. Mm-hmm. Now, when the trees were cut down 300 years ago, 200 years ago, they released a lot of carbon, but that's worked its way through the system, and the reforestation intake or uptake of carbon has not worked its way through the system. It's still a benefit that sits out there. But this is the kind of thing that a court simply can't grapple with. It's not something that lawyers really can grapple with in a legal litigation setting. And I think over time, the real facts will sort themselves out, and we'll know, and we'll have the capacity technologically to address these problems if it turns out that they really are as dire as some people think. But, you know, the predictions of polar bears disappearing, predictions of no more glaciers in the Himalayas, predictions of major sea level increases, all those predictions and all those dire statements have not proved true.
Amen.
That doesn't mean there isn't a problem, but it does mean that it's a good thing we didn't fall on our sword and destroy our economy for something that turned out not to be true.
Amen.
We do have yet another question pending. We've got a few minutes left. You can push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join the queue. For now, let's go to our next caller.
I was just curious. You said you mentioned the second largest source of greenhouse gassing, but what is the largest source? I missed that.
Well, it's CO2, and that's a combination of what's known in environmental law as a combination of stationary sources, electricity generation, utilities, on the one hand, and mobile sources, cars, trucks, and buses, on the other. And up until fairly recently, the largest source of CO2 in America, emitted by American enterprises, has been utilities. But with the displacement of coal by natural gas, the mantle has sort of shifted to the transportation sector as the largest source of CO2. But combined, that's the largest single source of CO2. Now, when you get into other greenhouse gases like chlorofluorocarbons, you know, that's a question of refrigeration and, you know, refrigerators, air conditioners, both in cars and in the home. And you know, there are all kinds of comparisons that can be made. Again,
but that's more related to the ozone layer.
Well, that's why it was done. That's why it was done. But it turns out that these same products are highly potent greenhouse gas. I'll tell you one little anecdote about this, which always used to irritate me when I was in the White House. We had, as I said, taken steps to implement the so-called Montreal Protocol, which was implemented or decided or ratified under Reagan, but it was implemented as Title VI of the Clean Air Act to reduce chlorofluorocarbons, which the motivating factor being the ozone hole in the stratosphere. So, but we wanted to take credit. This is in the election effort. We wanted to say, look, we've made a down payment on climate change. Climate change science was a lot less definitive then than it is now, and so it wasn't that big an issue. But we wanted to say, look, we've taken measures to make pretty significant reductions in greenhouse gases already, and the scientists all told us, including scientists who were in the White House working for President Bush 41, President Bush Sr., we were told in no uncertain terms, chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, are not greenhouse gases. Well, guess
They're
what?
Not.
Oh, they are.
Oh, so they are.
On January 21st, 1993, guess what? They were classified as greenhouse gases. And that just shows you how political this whole thing is.
There was no scientific basis for that classification.
It was purely political. They didn't want the liberals, the environmentalists, didn't want a Republican taking credit for any environmental benefit. You know, that's Republicans don't clean up the environment. All they do is dirty it. That's the narrative of the media and Democrats. And it's quite vicious, and so vicious that, you know, we weren't permitted to even speak of CFCs as greenhouse gases. But lo and behold, on January 21st, magically, they became a greenhouse gas when a Democrat was in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So that just goes, I mean, that's just a political fact which occurred, and it always used to frustrate me. Now it amuses me.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone now. This is the time for the final question. And I'll make a quick observation while you two were chatting. I looked up on carinsurance.com. California has nearly twice as many. When you mention the transportation sector, it sparks some thought here, but has nearly twice as many cars as the next closest state, registered vehicles as the next closest state, 27.6 million compared to 14 million in Texas, and more than twice as many licensed drivers as well of the next closest state, again, Texas. So some interesting statistics there. It looks like we have had our final question, Ambassador Gray. Do you want to express a final thought before we adjourn the call?
Well, your comment about California is I think, you know, a jumping off point for making a final sort of comment that somehow the oil companies are blamed for the consumption of oil and therefore the production of some CO2. But look at all the customers out there. Look at all the drivers in California, 24 million, whatever the number is. I mean, you know, they're not being forced to burn oil by Exxon. They want to burn gasoline so they can get around Los Angeles and they can, you know, get around the state, which is very, very big. And so we're all complicit in this. If there is complicity to be handed out, we're all complicit. Those of us who drive to work or who take public transit to work are using energy to do that, and so we're all part of this. And it's not Exxon is providing a service to us. It's not us being commanded to do anything by Exxon.
Well, Ambassador Gray, my thanks to you on my own behalf, but also on behalf of the Federal Society and our callers. We certainly appreciate your analysis here. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call tomorrow at noon, we'll be talking about the Parsonage Housing Allowance. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.